Welcome to the Books of Titans podcast, where I seek truth in the world's great books. I'm your host, Eric Rostad, coming to you from the beautiful Books of Titans studio in Franklin, Tennessee. My goal is to read 200 of the great books over the next 10 years and share what I'm learning. I'll talk a bit about each book, tie ideas together from a variety of genres, and share the one thing I always hope to remember from each of the great books. Well, today I have a special episode here. I'm talking to Dr. Jason A. Staples. He is my go-to biblical scholar, and each year I start off reading straight through the Bible. It takes me January and February, so this is going to be the episode where I cap off that whole experience for this year. And as I read the Bible, every time I just have so many questions. There's so many things I don't understand, and I usually just kind of write those questions in the margin, knowing that I will be able to ask them of Dr. Jason Staples. So actually, first, before I ever think of asking, I actually try to see if the Bible answers those questions as I encounter them. So I will write them in the margins, and then we'll just kind of keep that in my head as I'm reading through the rest of the Bible. So my hope is that I actually get the question answered while reading the Bible. But some of these questions are just, maybe they have more to do with scholarship or archaeology or just different questions where I'm not certain of the answer after having read through the rest of the Bible. So with those, I keep those, and then I try to ask Dr. Staples each year a set of these questions. So this year I have four questions, and I'm going to ask him at the start of this episode. And then Dr. Jason Staples wrote a book that I covered earlier this year. I read it late last year, 2023, and then covered it as one of the first episodes of this year. And that is Paul and the Resurrection of Israel. And so I had a couple questions for him about that book as well. So that'll be this episode, a couple questions about the Bible, and then a little discussion about Jason's latest book. So I hope you enjoy. We'll get right into it here. I've got Jason with me here today, and this is the third time I've gone straight through the Bible. And each time I just start making a list of questions as I'm going through. And so I've picked out a few here that are the most pressing for this year. So I'm going to get right into it. This is Dr. Jason Staples. So the first question I have is about the land. And this is kind of the main thing that that kept coming up in this year's reading is the land of Israel. And I guess just with everything going on in our current time in that area, but then also the promises that we see in Genesis, they're for the land, but it's an everlasting promise. And that's where I kept getting tripped up, because what does it mean for them to have the land forever? Like the term forever kept being used, or everlasting. And yet they were exiled from there. And then, I guess just kind of in general, if there's a promise in the Bible that is everlasting or forever, what does that mean, especially in the light of the land where it, from all appearances, it's not everlasting?
Yeah, it's a good question. One of the things, and this is actually one of the more difficult matters of translation when it comes to both Hebrew and Greek, is you get this word in Hebrew, in the Hebrew Bible, the promise is normally that's translated everlasting or forever is olam, is the Hebrew word. Which really means something like an age. It sometimes in later rabbinic readings is actually associated with the world. You know, the common Jewish blessing or beginning of a prayer would be Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, king of the world, or king forever, this sort of thing. But it doesn't mean exactly the same thing as like our concept of like forever in terms of extended time, indefinitely, you know, infinitely into the future, or eternity, which would be potentially in both directions, but it can kind of mean that too. So it's a little bit complicated. I think the basic though idea in something like Genesis, which is where you've got this this promise of everlasting, or, you know, this blessing, you know, to the age. The idea is that what God is conferring or what God is promising is it's God's land. And actually, in later Jewish readings of this, and also early Christian readings of this, the land is the other interesting thing about this is that Aretz Haaretz or Eretz in Hebrew can mean either land, like as in the land, like specific proper. It can mean land as in like the dirt, or it can mean the earth as in like the whole like place where there's dirt. Mm-hmm. And so like later on when you get Jesus saying blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the land. That's geis in Greek, which is a translation of the same Eretz, and that has the same thing. It can mean either like land as in dirt, it can mean the land as in like this land, or it can mean world. And so later on it gets interpreted as a promise not only of that Abraham and his seed would possess that specific land, but that ultimately that promise extends to possession of the whole world, and that God would rule the whole world through Abraham and his seed, which is where you actually get the idea that Jesus, as the ultimate seed of Abraham and the proper descendant of David, is king of the whole world, ruling from heaven, kind of idea. That derives from that. So you take those two things together, you will, this will be your land. I promise this land to you and your seed forever. But okay, is it this land or is it the world? Is it the whole earth? And is forever like from now until like indefinite time in the future? Or is that for like an age that is the next age, for example? That might be the case. So there are a lot of different ways of reading it. I think the general thing that comes in within the tradition, and this is a tension that's in those texts from the beginning, because these are written for people who remember this, who know about this promise, and they're reading about this promise, and the presumed reader of these texts knows full well that they're currently not in possession of those things. There's a tension baked in from the beginning. That this is rightful, this is how things should be, but things are not as they should be in the present, but they will be that way in the future. And there's a continued explanation throughout these texts that there is that the reason things aren't as they should be is that even though those promises are made in a sort of unconditional fashion, the actual participation in those promises in the present is contingent on obedience and contingent on actually doing what God wants. And so that's where you see like the transition from Genesis 15, where God makes the promise to Abraham the first time. And then Genesis 16, where he takes it into his own, I guess I would say hands, but it's not exactly hands, to try to fulfill that promise with Hagar, which is a word for the stranger, by the way. And then chapter 17, once Ishmael reaches age of maturity, God shows back up and goes, I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be blameless. And then explains, so here's the deal. As for me, I will do what I promised you. As for you, you've got some things you've got to do in order for this to actually work out this way. So the emphasis then in the narrative keeps coming back to, yeah, the promises of God will work out, but it's not, even if they're unconditional promises, your participation in them is somewhat conditional in that you have to actually walk with God in that way. So that mm-hmm. that's kind of baked into the whole narrative to make it work this way.
Yeah, that's so interesting because so I did the Robert Alter translation for the Old Testament, and I didn't read all the commentary. I read it all for Genesis, but for the New Testament, I did the David Bentley Hart translation, and he was big on that idea of age, and he translated everything as age. And then in the postscript, he said exactly what you were just saying there's this tension with, first off, there's not an idea of forever as we have it in these words. And he was highlighting it from the New Testament side of things, but yeah, I find that very interesting. And then your answer is a great segue into my second question, because and you mentioned, I think, just even a couple covenants or kind of iterations on the covenant, but there were a number of covenants. And so when we're further on in the Bible and it's referring back to either the old covenant or the covenant I made with your fathers, what is the covenant that is being referred to? Is it a combination of all of those, or is there a specific one that had precedence over the others?
So again, this is a little bit contingent on interpretive tradition. There are different ways of reading it. If you want to look at how this tends to be read by the New Testament authors, and I think in the earliest Christian groups, the covenant, the primary covenant that everything goes back to is Abraham's covenant.
Okay.
And, so essentially the promise of God to Abraham that this is how this is going to be, and that everything that follows Abraham's covenant is sort of narrowing the scope of that covenant and, facilitating and providing for how that covenant is actually going to be fulfilled. So everything after that is a renewal of that covenant. Okay. And even the interesting thing, though, is that even Abraham's covenant, to some degree, goes all the way back to, Noah and Adam, the blessings that are given to them and extended to all of humanity. But the reason that Abraham's covenant becomes like the covenant is that the promise is that in your seed, all nations will be blessed. And that's to Abraham. So the way that the earlier notions of God dealing with humanity, that they're going to be addressed, is through Abraham and through what God is doing with Abraham and Abraham's seed. So that becomes the primary covenant. And everything after that is basically a renewal of, or a specification of, or a narrowing, or a clarification of that particular covenant. That's the way that that's usually understood, especially in the Christian tradition.
Okay, cool. During this reading, I was struck probably for the first time of just the timing of everything, and especially with when these texts would have been compiled. And so, whereas I guess before I would have looked at it as like purely as like, oh wow, this is prophetic. They were predicting exactly what was going to happen. Where in reality, like if it's about the exile, they're compiling this during exile. So this is a very broad question, but just in my reading this year, I was struck by that tension, I guess. But then also, the main question here is, when they're compiling these texts, are we to understand that these texts existed and so they were compiling, or are they writing these texts at that time, like during the Babylonian exile, to where like the things that were prophetic for the coming exile and all that, would they have had that? Or was it kind of more of like, okay, now we're in exile, so we're making sense of this. And so I know that's very broad, but like, was there like a Deuteronomy well before it's compiled in Babylonian exile, or is it kind of being put together at that point?
Yeah. What you're basically asking then, if I'm hearing you correctly, is this all, ex eventu? Is this all prophecy after the fact? So, mm-hmm. These predictions are predictions of what we already know happened, and therefore we can kind of write the past as though we're writing from the past into the present. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, and kind of in the sense of like, because there's warnings, like if you do this or if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. But they're already in that state. So was it the understanding of the earlier people that was in the cultural ideas?
Yeah, so there are different answers to this, as with everything else. But my general view on this is that there was not Deuteronomy in the sense of like the book that we have prior to the exile, because that book is compiled later, and it's put together with the knowledge of all the stuff that happened. So when you read that, these are people who are aware of what happened. But I think it's based on and built off of significantly earlier material where exactly these things are being said by prophets who are warning the people. Okay. So, you know, I think like with Jeremiah, for example, I think the prophet Jeremiah, the book of Jeremiah is edited together by followers of Jeremiah, essentially, and people who, you know, have access to these materials in the exile. And, you know, I think the editing of Jeremiah goes on, you know, well past the Babylonian exilic period into the Persian period, probably. But I do think that there is a historical Jeremiah who said all these things and warned that, you know, Babylon's coming. Here's what's going to happen. This is because of this. And that the reason that these things got preserved and written down and then ultimately put together and codified is precisely because people recognize that, like, sure looks like Jeremiah was right about this. Right. So, similar with several others. I mean, I think that there is, you know, that there was a pre-exilic, you know, 8th century Isaiah of Jerusalem, and that Isaiah made specific prophecies about specific things that ultimately happened along the lines of what he said would happen. And that then the people later on were like, you know, that guy's warnings, they kind of checked out. And so you preserve that. Mm-hmm. Now you say, did the people think these things? Well, that's a more complicated thing, because the evidence in the Bible, and I think the archaeological evidence also corresponds with this. The evidence is that the prophets, that the witness that we see in the stuff that's collected in the Bible, this is the Minority Report. Mm-hmm. So if you're familiar with the old movie Minority Report, you know, you have something like that where the prophets are the ones, they're the contrarians within the society. They're not the majority. The majority of Judahites and Israelites before the exile did not hold to the theological notions that we see in today's Bible. Most of them were the people that the prophets, whose opinions are preserved in today's Bible, strongly disagreed and criticized and critiqued and said, you guys are going to wind up getting us all, you know, that. The majority of the people were doing that. And if you look at the archaeological evidence, the majority of Israelites were polytheists who worshiped other gods in addition to the you know, to Adonai, the God of Israel. They worshiped, say, Asherah or various Asherot or as feminine consorts with Adonai. They worshiped Baal and El. They worshiped various Shaddai spirits. They worshiped a variety of different things. And participated in all sorts of illicit, according to the biblical editors who are horrified by these things, activities. I think there's strong evidence that throughout Judah, child sacrifice was practiced for generations, you know, all the way up basically until the generation prior to the exile. You have the kings themselves formerly active in sacrificing their own children. And I think this was a widespread practice. I think there's evidence for that in Judah. Well, the biblical prophets are horrified by this and they continually criticize this, but I think most of the people in the society just disagree with them. Mm-hmm. And then after the exile, what happens is that minority voice gets amplified as, well, you know, maybe those guys had something, you know, maybe there was something that they got right on this and that the majority didn't figure out. So I think that's part of it. And I think as far as Deuteronomy, I tend to fall in the camp that I think there's a layer of Deuteronomy that goes back at least to Hezekiah. Some of that source material probably goes back at least to Hezekiah and then is kind of renewed during Josiah's time. And then what you've got at Josiah's time kind of goes into exile with the people that that get exiled by Babylon shortly thereafter. And then that gets codified and edited up during that exile. So I think that's most likely what's going on. So you've got, you know, 8th century and 6th century material that finally gets edited probably around the 5th century.
Okay. Last question here in the Bible. Robert Alter really points out the difference between prose and poetry in the Hebrew Bible. Is there some sort of a way that that's distinguished in the way Hebrew is written? Like, it's kind of a dumb question, but like, in English, poetry will usually be like a smaller column and italicized or whatever to say, hey, this is poetry, as opposed to prose, which just kind of takes up the whole page. Is there some sort of way that's distinguished in Hebrew, or is it just more of like the comparison aspect of the parallelism aspect of Hebrew poetry?
Yeah, for the most part, and again, there's manuscript traditions from different eras in this, but for the most part, you don't have like poetic indent in these texts. You don't have something like that. You recognize it by the combination of the kind of parallelism that you see in there. First of all, there's some debate about whether or not there's a metrical quality, you know, how much meter there is in Hebrew poetry. Mm-hmm. I fall on the side that there probably is some aspect of meter that's there for some of these things. I mean, these things were generally the Hebrew poetry, just like a lot of poetry or most poetry through human history. I mean, most poetry today is sung. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that they're memorizing poetry all the time when they're listening to music, but mm-hmm. you know, a lot of this was put to music. And I think there's a metrical quality to a lot of that, you know, you just kind of know when you hear it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of, and there's certain biblical verses and areas where even somebody who's not as accustomed to that kind of thing, you can kind of hear it in with your ear that like, there's something that would be probably metrical to this. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's there, but I think in general, it's the kind of thing where you recognize it based on the formal qualities rather than how it's written, you know, and that's kind of how it works in antiquity.
Okay.
With the manuscripts. Cool.
Well, you just had a book come out 2 months ago, January, and I covered that on a previous podcast episode. I called it a masterpiece, and I don't think I've ever said that about a book, but just, I mean, it was incredible, and I just wanted to ask a couple questions about this. This took 20 years of your life, these two books that you recently wrote, and I'm just curious what stood out to you or surprised you the most? This all started with a question that you had from Ezekiel in the way terms were used and Israel and Judah and Israel not existing at that point. And that started this whole quest that led to these eventual two books. From that time that you started until you wrote these books, what is there one thing that stood out to you that was just like the biggest surprise to you, I guess, from that initial question that you had?
Maybe the biggest surprise actually goes back to the book before this, which was when I sort of discovered where the majority of biblical scholarship today got the idea that, so when I was reading through, you allude to the distinction between Israel or Israelite and the concept of Israelite meaning a larger group than Jews, which are a subset of Israel, which became pretty apparent pretty early in the process. So I sort of recognized that early on, and then started pulling out the thread, and I noticed that was really consistent throughout that. But what I was surprised by, and this actually it surprised me so much that I then had to write the first book to actually address it. What surprised me was that biblical scholarship and scholarship on early Judaism for the last few generations, didn't generally take that view. And where they actually got the consensus view before my work came from was from a scholar from Germany in the 1930s who was a member of the Nazi party. Mm-hmm. When I discovered that, it was one of those, like, it was one of those moments where I just went, Oh, that was probably the most surprising thing, was recognizing that all of these, you know, cause I kept finding in scholarship, like, well, you know, we obviously know that things work this way. And I'd be like, where did that come from? And then when I finally teased it back and I discovered that it goes back to one theological dictionary of the Old Testament article from the 1930s. And then I discovered who that was by and all, that was probably the most surprising thing. As far as some of the rest of it, I don't know that there's anything that was especially surprising as much as it was fascinating to me to sort of watch how things kind of snap into place once you take a slightly different, once you start looking at some of these texts from a different starting point. Hmm. And you go, oh, that passage that has been a problem for a long time, that's not the problem. The problem was this assumption. And then once you get rid of that, these things, these like five or six passages just all snap together. And this makes sense. Hmm. This argument makes sense. That kept happening in the process. And I wouldn't call that a surprise as much as just sort of one of the things that I gained a great appreciation for throughout the process was the degree to which there was, or there's just such a kind of elegant simplicity that underlies a lot of this, while there is so much intertextual sophistication across a lot of these texts. Wow. So, you know, that was something that really stood out throughout.
Hmm. That's neat. In the episode that I did, I covered three areas that what was presented in the book is different from what I had grown up hearing or believed. And was there anything where you changed a belief or a thought based? It's kind of tied into that first question, but based on what you discovered, any change there for you?
Yeah, there were a lot of them. It's interesting because I've been doing this so long, over 20 years, that just even thinking about that question, I have to, this is the interesting thing is when you spend a lot of time with something, it's easy to forget where you started.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to forget what you once thought on certain things, to even be able to answer that question well. I changed my view on a number of things. I'd have to think about what some of those would be. I'm actually looking
at my... funny. It's funny too. There was a comment on Twitter about your book where somebody put a meme up where it was like, nothing will be the same after this or something along those lines.
And that's the same thing I
thought too, where it's like, it's such a shift where nothing is the same going forward. And especially, I'm so glad your book came right before I read through the Bible this year, because then I was able to read it in that way and see what you'd been talking about. And it's one of those things like, this shifts everything going forward to where it is hard to look back and be like, oh, what did I think before? But, cause it's such a shift.
Yeah. I remember that meme. It was actually, the Joker from the Dark Knight of, there's no going.
Yeah.
You've changed things, you know? So, but then there was also the second one, which I thought was just as funny, where it was like, yeah, there's going to lead to a certain amount of cringe of like, you know, I'm something of an Israelite myself,
yeah.
You know, going back to, Spider-Man, I think that's Spider-Man 2 or Spider-Man 3. I can't remember.
Okay.
No, that was from Spider-Man 1. That's the Green Goblin who says that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I think a couple things that I shifted my view on in this that I, as I learned through, one is, in Romans chapter 9, there's this whole section about, dishonored vessels and, you know, God making vessels for one purpose and another, and, you know, the sovereignty of God kind of thing. I, on a close reading of that passage, came to realize that my own reading of that and the default reading that, you know, had been that I'd been taught for many years, didn't really hold up in terms of the Greek grammar or in terms of the argumentation of the larger passage. So that this is not a matter, you know, the usual way that passage is taken. This is God as potter who has the, you know, capacity to, do with anybody as he sees fit. And, you know, none of us have really any say in how God chooses to form us. And none of us have any right to complain because he's the potter and he can kind of do whatever he wants. And, you know, who are we to think that we could even resist his hand? And, you know, it's just because God says it's just. So being based basically a defense of God being able to act in a sort of arbitrary way. When I took a closer look at that passage, that's almost exactly the opposite of how that passage works, which, you know, first of all, you understand that in the ancient world and in the modern world, clay is understood as notoriously difficult to work with, and headstrong is, you know, it's used, you get this notion of clay as having a mind of its own, as a consistent kind of feature, and that being a good potter means learning to improvise and to work within the constraints that stubborn clay puts you in. And this is a notion that goes all the way back to Jeremiah 18. And once you read that passage that way, it really changes things, because the idea is, are you actually going to submit to the hand of God and the direction that he wants to form you? Or is he going to have to kind of improvise and form you into something else? And so that, yeah, he's kind of got final say, but you're going to have some, this is a dynamic relational kind of thing that's baked into the metaphor that I hadn't appreciated before that. You know, some other things that shifted in this, another was the sort of cosmic aspect of Paul's understanding and how the nations themselves, this is not just a matter of, you know, Paul being inclusive and therefore, you know, the Gentiles can come in and be saved too. This is a matter of the victory of the God of Israel over the other gods as well. And, you know, over the gods of the nations. And I think that's something that Paul takes seriously, that, you know, we tend to be in a kind of quasi monotheist, if theistic at all, kind of culture now, where the presumption is, well, there's God, and then, you know, that, you know, that's not the world that they're living in. And this is a concept where, you know, Paul sees the God of Israel as vanquishing the gods of the other nations in all of this, in a way that I think that's another piece that, I didn't appreciate to that degree before doing all of this. And then in Rome, and I think maybe the biggest shift was my understanding of Romans 10, which is, I think, it's a pivotal chapter that everybody looks back to when you're talking about, you know, Christianity and traditional Christian teaching. I mean, this is the chapter with, you know, if you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart is how it's usually rendered, that Jesus rose from the dead, then you'll be saved. You know, as it is written, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. You know, you have this whole thing. And I spent a long time in that chapter, because there's some places where, as much as everybody kind of goes to it as like, wow, there's, you know, some really easy, pithy sayings here that you can summarize the gospel with. The question is, do we understand what those sayings mean? And my views on that chapter and how that sort of interacts with some of the ideas in Galatians and other places shifted pretty significantly in the process of this. And I felt like I finally cracked it. In you know, sort of that was the last chapter that I wrote for this book. And that chapter, when that nut finally started to turn, it was like, oh, that's what's happening. And, you know, it's not a matter of Paul setting one verse from the Torah over and against another verse from the Torah. He's using both to supplement each other, but he's treating one as from one age and another as referring to the present after Jesus dispenses the Spirit. And this is why he makes the distinction that he does. And you can see the same movement happening in Galatians 3. So that was something, just that whole chapter, which is chapter 6 in the book, that was the product of something that just radically shifted in my own reading, and I'll never be able to see it differently now. Yeah. I mean, it very much is one of those like, oh, this just makes sense of the whole thing. And it's a really complicated chapter. You know, he's writing very compressed language at the time. Mm-hmm. In that chapter, and kind of a presuming that you can follow the biblical intertext underlying it over and over again. And I think he overshoots his audience. He overshot me. And it took a while to realize that, oh, that's what's happening. And that was definitely something that might be the chapter that I'm most proud of in this book, is, you know, I know how much I wrestled with that to kind of figure out what happened there. And I felt like it came out well.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you for those two books. They're amazing. And thank you for answering these questions. I hope to keep doing this each year. New questions come up, and you're my go-to source. So thank you.
Yeah, I miss doing this podcast with you. I mean, I remember we launched this together. I don't know how many years ago now, but it was your baby all along, and I just couldn't keep up. So, you know, it turns out writing books took more energy than I thought they would on that front, and I couldn't do both the keeping up with your pace on reading while getting some of that stuff done. But yeah, I really miss being able to do this as well, and thanks for incorporating me still once in a while.
Yeah, it's great. We got to do it more. All right, thanks, Jason.
Yep, thank you, Eric.